she decorated with the words, "Soldier, get your leg over today. You might not be able to tomorrow." And just for that, furthermore, one of the girls had the clap, as it turned out, which contravenes the law concerning sabotage and the undermining of military readiness.
"I understand, Mr. Cranmer."
Yara stood up straight in a position he considered soldierly. "But don't worry about me. I'm no defeatist. You haven't understood shit. And don't interrupt me, because I haven't finished. That last hanged man, the one stinking to high heaven, was only guilty of reacting to the chatter of a provocateur snooper with the shout, 'You were right, sir. It's like that, and not otherwise, as 2 plus 2 makes 4. Now tell me if you understand."
"I do."
Yara looked around furtively.
"I shall be careful, but... Mr. Cranmer, what's it really like?"
The dwarf also looked around. "It's like this," he said softly. "Marshal Menokuhorn's Center Army Group is marching north with a force of around 100,000 men. Indeed, were it not for the insurrection in Verden, they'd already be here. Indeed, it would be better if negotiations were to take place. Indeed, Temeria and Redania don't have the forces to stop Kuhorn. Indeed, not before the strategic border of the Pontar."
"The River Pontar," whispered Yara, "is north of here."
"That's exactly what I wanted to say. But remember, keep your trap shut about that."
"I'll beware. When I'm in my unit, will I also have to? May I also encounter a snooper?"
"In a frontline unit? Near the front?" "Not really. Snoopers are so ardent behind the front because they're afraid of ending up on it. Furthermore, if they hung every soldier what grumbles, complains and swears, there'd be no one left to fight. But, like you did with the matter of Ciri, Yara, always keep your trap shut. Mark my words, no dungfly ever flew into a trap that was shut. Now go. I'll take you to the committee."
"Will you put in a good word for me?"
Yara looked at the dwarf, hopefully.
"Hey, Mr. Cranmer?"
"Dear me, you're an ass, Mr. Scribe. This is the army. If I put in a good word for you and tried pulling strings, it would be as though I'd embroidered lemon on your back in gold thread. You'd have a hard time in your troop, laddie."
"What about if I joined," blinked Yara, "your unit?"
"Don't even think about it."
"Because there's only room for dwarves in it, right?"
the boy said bitterly.
"And not for me."
"Right. Not for you," thought Dennis Cranmer. "Not for you, Yara. Because I still have unpaid debts with Nenica, which is why I'd prefer you to return from the war in one piece, and the Mahakam Volunteer Regiment, consisting of dwarves, specimens of a foreign and inferior race, will always be sent to the lousiest tasks, to the worst sectors. The ones you don't come back from. The ones you don't sense humans to."
"So how can I make sure," Yara continued downcast, "that I'll end up in a good troop?
And which one, according to you, is so first-rate it's worth trying to get into?"
Yara turned around on hearing singing, swelling like a breaking wave, growing like the thunder of an approaching storm. Loud, powerful, swaggering singing as hard as steel. He'd heard singing like that before. The mercenary troop, formed up into threes, walked their horses along the narrow street leading from the castle. At their head, on a grey stallion, beneath a pole decorated with human skulls, rode the commander, a grey-haired man with an aquiline nose and hair plaited into a queue falling down onto his armour.
"Adam Madhu Pangrat," mumbled Dennis Cranmer.
The singing of the mercenaries thundered, roared and rumbled. Counterpointed by the ringing of horseshoes on cobbles, it filled the narrow street way up to the tops of the houses and into the blue sky above the town.
"No lovers or wives spill tears when the time comes to bite the blood-soaked dust, for we briskly go to war for the ducat as red as the sun."
"You ask what troop?" said Yara,
unable to tear his eyes from the cavalryman.
"Why, one like that. In one such as that, I'd like to..."
"Each has his song," the dwarf interrupted quietly. "And each bites the blood-soaked earth his own way, just as it befalls him. And they either cry for him or not. In a war, scribbler, you only sing and march as one. You stand in the ranks as one.
And later, in battle, everyone gets what is written for him, whether in a Dŵr Pangrat's free company, or in the infantry, or in the convoys. Whether in a shining suit of armour with a glorious crest, or in bast shoes and a flea-ridden sheepskin coat. Whether on a fleet steed or behind a shield. Something different comes to each one, as it befalls him. Well, and there's the commission. Do you see the sign above the entrance? That's your way, since you've thought to become a soldier. Go, Yara. Farewell. We'll meet again when it's all over. The dwarf's gaze followed the boy until he disappeared into the door of the tavern, occupied by the recruiting commission. Or we won't meet again, he added softly. No one knows what's written for anybody, or what will befall them.
Can you ride? Can you shoot a longbow or crossbow?
No, sir, but I can write and calligraph ancient runes, too. I know the elder speech.
Can you wield a sword? Are you trained in lance play?
I've read the History of Wars, the work by Marshal Pellegram, and Roderick de Novembre.
Or perhaps you know how to cook.
No, I don't. But I reckon up well.
The recruiting officer grimaced and waved a hand.
A well-read smart aleck. You're not the first today. Write about a chitty for the PFI. You'll be serving in the PFI, lad. Run with this chitty to the southern end of the town, then be on the Maribor Gate down by the lake. But you'll find it for sure. Next!
Hey, Yara! Hey, wait! Melfi? Who else?
The cooper's son staggered, holding onto the wall.
It's me, right here.
What's wrong with you?
Wrong? With me? Nothing. We've had a bit to drink. We drank to Nilfgaard's confusion. Ugh, Yar. I'm glad to see you, for I thought I'd lost you somewhere. My comrade.
Yara stepped back as though someone had hit him. For the cooper's son's breath didn't only smell of second-rate beer and third-rate vodka, but also of onions, garlic, and God knows what else, very intensively. And where, Yara asked sneeringly, is your eminent company?
You asking about Pike?
Melfi grimaced.
Then I'll tell you. To hell with him. Do you know Yara? I think he was a bad man.
Bravo. You saw through him quickly.
Didn't I just?
Melfi strutted, not noticing the mockery.
He hid it, but whoever cheats me can eat the devil. I tell you, I know what he was planning. What drew him here to Vachima? You probably think, Yara, that he and his miscreants came to sign up like us. Ha! Well, you're seriously mistaken. Do you know what he had planned? You wouldn't believe it.
I would.
He needed horses and uniforms,
Melfi finished triumphantly.
He meant to steal them from round here, for he meant to go to war in disguised as a soldier.
Let him end his days on the gallows.
The quicker the better.
The cooper's son staggered slightly, stopped by the wall and undid his breeches.
I'm just sorry that Ogrubeck and Milton, those stupid village idiots, were taken in. They followed Pike, so they're liable to meet the hangman too. Well, bollocks to them, effing bumpkins. And how goes it with you, Yara?
Regarding?
Did the recruiting officers post you anywhere?
Melfi sent a stream of piss down the whitewashed wall.
I asked because I'm already recruited. I'm to go through the Maribor Gate to the southern end of the castle. And where do you have to go?
To the south side too.
Ha!
The cooper's son jumped up and down a few times, shook and fastened his trousers.
So we're to fight together?
I don't think so. Yara looked at him condescendingly. I was assigned in accordance with my qualifications, to the PFI.
Well, naturally.
Melfi hiccuped and breathed his dreadful mixture over him.
You're book learned. They probably assign smart alecks like you to important matters, not any old ones. Well, what to do? But for now, we'll be travelling a little longer together, for our route's to the southern end of the castle.
Looks like it.
Let's go then.
Let's go.
I don't think it's here,
judged Yara, looking at a parade square surrounded by tents, where a troop of scruffs with long sticks on their shoulders were kicking up dust. Every scruff, as the boy observed, had a bunch of hay attached to his right leg and a bunch of straw attached to his left.
I think we've come to the wrong place, Melfi.
Straw? Hay!
The roar of the lance corporal directing the scruffs could be heard from the parade square.
Straw? Hay! Even it up, for fuck's sake!
A standard's fluttering over the tents, said Melfi. See for yourself, Yara. Those same lilies what you were talking about on the road. Is there a standard? There is. Is there an army? There is. That means it's here. We've come to the right place.
You maybe. Not me, for sure.
Some officer or other is standing there by the fence. Let's ask him.
It moved fast after that.
New recruits? Yelled the sergeant. From the conscription office? Papers? What the fuck are you standing one behind the other? March on the spot. Don't fucking stand there. Left turn. About turn. Right fucking turn. Quick march. About fucking turn. Listen and remember. First of fucking all, get to the quartermaster. Get your kit. Mail, shirt, boots, pike, helmet and sword, for fuck's sake. Then to the drill ground. Be ready for the fucking muster at dusk. Quick march!
Just a minute.
Yara looked around hesitantly.
Because I think I have a different posting.
What?
I beg your pardon, officer, sir.
Yara blushed.
I only want to prevent a possible error. For the commissioner, clearly, he distinctly spoke of a posting to the PFI. So I...
You're at home, my lad,
snorted the sergeant, somewhat disarmed by the officer.
This is your posting. Welcome to the poor fucking infantry.
And why? Repeated Rocco Hildebrandt. And for what reason are we to pay you gentlemen tax? We've already paid everything we are supposed to.
Blow this! Look at him, the smart-ass tarfling.
Pike, sprawled on the saddle of a stolen horse, grinned at his comrades.
He's already paid, and he thinks that's all. Really, he's the spitting image of that turkey, what we're thinking about Sunday. But they chopped his head off on Saturday.
A Kultich, Klaproth, Milton and Ogrebeck cackled in unison. The joke was excellent, after all, and the amusement promised to be even more excellent. Rocco noticed the revolting, clammy gazes of the marauders and looked back. On the threshold of his cottage stood Incarvilia Hildebrandt, his wife, and Allo and Yasmin, his two daughters. Pike and his company looked at the hobbit girls, smiling lecherously. Yes, assuredly the amusement promised to be first class. Impacientia Vanderbeck, Hildebrandt's niece, normally called by the pet name Impy, approached the hedge on the other side of the highway. She was a very pretty girl. The bandit's smiles became even more lecherous and revolting.
Well, shorty?
Pike hurried him.
Hand over the penny to the royal army. Give us your victuals, give us your horses, and lead the cows from the cowshed. We aren't going to stand here till sundown. We must get round a few more villages today.
Why must we pay and hand over our food?
Rocco Hildebrandt's voice trembled slightly, but determination and doggedness still resounded in it.
You say it's for the army, that it's for our defence, and who, I ask, will defend us against hunger? We've already paid the winter levy and the geld and the poll tax and the land tax and the animal tax, and the devil only knows what else. If that wasn't enough, four halflings from this hamlet, my son included in that number, are coach drivers in the army convoys. And no one else but my brother-in-law, Milo Vanderbeck, known as Rusty, is a field surgeon, an important personage in the army. That means we've paid our acreage with interest. For what reason are we to pay more? Wherefore? And what for? And why?
Pike gave a long look at Incarvilia Hildebrandt, née Bibervelt, the halfling's wife, at their plump daughters, Allo and Yasmin, at the gorgeous Impy Vanderbeck, dressed in a green frock, at Sam Hoffmeyer and his grandfather, old Grandpa Holofernes, at Granny Petunia, doggedly picking at a flowerbed with a hoe, at the other halflings from the hamlet, mainly womenfolk and youngsters, apprehensively peeping out from their households and from behind fences.
You ask why?
He hissed, leaning over in the saddle and looking into the halfling's terrified eyes.
I'll tell you why. Because you're a mangy halfling, a foreigner, a stranger, and whoever robs you, you repulsive brute, delights the gods. Whoever vexes you, non-human, is carrying out a good and patriotic deed. And also, because I feel sick with a desire to send your non-human nest up in smoke. Because I feel a yen coming on to fuck your midget women. And because we're five burly fellows and you're a handful of short-arsed wretches. Now do you know why?
Now I know, said Rocco Hildebrandt slowly. Off with your big fog. Be gone, you good-for-nothings. We shan't give you anything.
Pike straightened up and reached for the short sword hanging from his saddle.
Have at them, he yelled. Kill them!
With a movement so fast it was almost imperceptible, Rocco Hildebrandt stooped down towards his barrow, took out a crossbow concealed under a rush mat, brought it to his cheek, and sent a bolt straight into Pike's mouth, which was wide open in a yell. Incarvilia Hildebrandt, nee Bibervelt, swung her arm powerfully, and a sickle spun through the air, slamming into Milton's throat. The peasant's son puked blood and somersaulted backwards over his horse's rump, swinging his legs comically. Ogrebeck, moaning, tumbled beneath the horse's hooves, with Grandpa Holofernes's secateurs buried in his belly up to the handle's wooden facings. The strongman Klaproth aimed a club at the old man, but flew from the saddle, squealing inhumanly, caught right in the eye with a spike of a dibber flung by Impey van der Beek. Akultich reined his horse around and hoped to flee, but Granny Petunia sprang at him and jabbed the teeth of her rake into his thigh. Akultich cried out and fell, his foot caught in the stirrup, and the frightened horse dragged him across the sharp poles of the wattle fence. The brigand yelled and wailed as he was dragged, and Granny Petunia, with her rake, and Impey, with her curved pruning knife, followed him like two she-wolves. Grandpa Holofernes blew his nose loudly. The entire incident, from Pike's shout to Grandpa Holofernes blowing his nose, took more or less the same time it would to rapidly utter the sentence, "Halflings are incredibly fast and can throw all sorts of missiles unerringly." Rocco sat down on the cottage steps. His wife, Incarvilia Hildebrandt nee Bibervelt, planted herself beside him. Their daughters, Allo and Yasmin, went to help Sam Hoffmeyer finish off the wounded and strip the dead. Impey returned in her green frock with the sleeves spattered up to the elbows with blood. Granny Petunia also returned, walking slowly, panting, grunting, leaning on her blood-spattered rake and holding her lower back.
Oh, she's getting old, our granny, thought Hildebrandt.
Where should we bury the brigands, Mr. Rocco? Asked Sam Hoffmeyer.
Rocco Hildebrandt put his arm around his wife and looked up at the sky.
In the birch copse, he said, next to the other ones.
The sensational adventure of Mr. Malcolm Guthrie of Braymoor took the pages of many newspapers by storm. Even the Daily Mail of London devoted several lines to it in its column Bizarre. However, because very few of our readers read the press south of the Tweed, and if they do, then only newspapers more serious than the Daily Mail, let us remind you what happened. On the day of the 10th of March last year, Mr. Malcolm Guthrie went fishing to Loch Glasgarnoch. While there, Mr. Guthrie happened upon a young woman with an ugly scar on her face, sick. Riding a black mare, sick. In the company of a white unicorn, sick. Who were emerging from the fog and darkness, sick. The girl spoke to the dumbstruck Mr. Guthrie in a language which Mr. Guthrie was so kind as to describe as, we quote, probably French or some other dialect from the continent. Because Mr. Guthrie does not speak French or any other dialect from the continent, a conversation was not possible. The girl and the accompanying menagerie vanished, to quote Mr. Guthrie again, like a golden dream. Our comment. Mr. Guthrie's dream was undoubtedly as golden as the colour of the single malt whisky Mr. Guthrie customarily drinks, as we learned, drinking often and in such quantities that would explain the seeing of white unicorns, white mice, and monsters from lochs. And the question we would like to pose runs thusly. What did Mr. Guthrie think he was doing with a fishing rod by Loch Glasgarnoch,
4 days before the angling season began.
The Inverness Weekly, 18th of March, 1906 edition. Chapter 7. Along with the intensifying wind, the sky darkened from the west, and the clouds, approaching in waves, extinguished the constellations one after the other. The dragon went out, the winter maiden went out, and the 7 goats went out. The eye, which shines brightest and longest, went out. The edge of the horizon lit up with short-lived flashes of lightning. Thunder rolled with a dull rumble. The wind abruptly intensified, blowing dust and dry leaves into their eyes. The unicorn neighed and sent a mental signal. Ciri understood immediately what he wanted to say.
There's no time to lose. Our only hope is in a quick escape, to the right place and the right time. We must hurry, Star Eye. I am the master of worlds, she recalled. I am of the Elder Blood. I have power over time and place. I am of Lara Doran's blood.
Ihwarahwak's neighed, urged them on. Kelpie echoed him with a long drawn-out snort. Ciri put on her gloves.
I'm ready, she said.
A buzzing in her ears, a flash and brightness, and then darkness. The water in the lake and the early evening silence bore the curses of the Fisher King, who sat on his boat, jerking and tugging the line, trying to free a lure caught on the lake bottom. A dropped oar thudded. Nemu cleared her throat impatiently. Condwiramuirs turned away from the window and then bent over the etchings. One of the boards in particular caught her eye. A girl with windswept hair riding a black mare rearing up. Beside her, a white unicorn, also rampant, its mane blown around like the girl's.
I think that's the only fragment of the legend that historians have never quibbled about, commented the novice, unanimously regarding it as a fabrication and a fairy tale embellishment or a delirious metaphor. And painters and illustrators, spiting the scholars, took a liking to the episode. Look, Prithi, each picture is Ciri and the unicorn. What do we have here? Ciri and the unicorn on a cliff above a sea beach. And here, if you please, Ciri and the unicorn in a landscape like something from a drug-induced trance, at night beneath 2 moons.
Nemu said nothing.
In a word, Condwiramuirs tossed the boards onto the table. Everywhere it's Ciri and the unicorn. Ciri and the unicorn in the labyrinth of the worlds. Ciri and the unicorn in the abyss of times. Ciri and the unicorn, interrupted Nemu, looking at the window, at the lake, at the boat and the Fisher King thrashing around in it. Ciri and the unicorn emerged from nothingness like apparitions, suspended over some lake or other. And perhaps it's constantly the same lake, one that spans times and places like a bridge, at once different, but nonetheless the same.
I beg your pardon?
Apparitions.
Nemu wasn't looking at her.
Visitors from other dimensions. Other planes, other places, other times. Apparitions that change someone's life. That also change their own life, their own fate, unbeknownst to them. For them, it's simply another place. Not that place, not that time. Once again, one more time in a row, not that time.
Nemu?
Condwiramuirs interrupted with a forced smile.
It's me who's the dream reader, let me remind you. I'm the expert on dream visions and oniroscopy. And all of a sudden, you begin to prophesy, as though you saw what you're talking about in a dream.
The Fisher King, judging by the sudden intensity of his voice and his cursing, had failed to unhitch the lure, and the line had snapped. Nemu said nothing and looked at the engravings. At Ciri and the unicorn.
I really have seen in a dream what I've been talking about, she finally said very calmly. I saw it many times in my dreams, and once while awake.
As it is known, the journey from Chuhos to Malbork may in certain conditions take even 5 days, and since the letters from the Chuhor's commander to Winrich von Knipprod, Grand Master of the Order, had without fail to reach the addressee no later than on the day of Pentecost, the knight, Heinrich von Schwelborn, didn't delay and set off the day after Sunday, Exaudi Domine, in order to travel peacefully and with no risk of being late, langsam abersicher. The knight's attitude greatly pleased his escort, which consisted of 6 mounted crossbowmen commanded by Hasso Planck, a baker's son from Cologne. The crossbowmen and Planck were more accustomed to noble gentlemen who swore, yelled, urged and ordered them to gallop at breakneck speed, and afterwards, when they didn't make it in time anyway, put all the blame on the poor infantry by lying in a way unbefitting a knight, not to mention one from a religious military order. It was warm, though overcast. It drizzled from time to time, and the ravines were enveloped in fog. The hills, overgrown by lush greenery, reminded Sir Heinrich of his native Thuringia, his mother, and the fact that he hadn't had a woman for over a month. The crossbowmen riding at the rear were languidly singing a ballad by Walter von der Vogelweide. Hasso Planck was dozing in the saddle. Wer gute Frau erlieberat, der schämt sich aller Misetat. The journey was proceeding peacefully, and who knows, perhaps it would have been peaceful all the way, had Sir Heinrich not noticed the glistening surface of a lake down below around noon. And because the following day was Friday, and it behoved them to get in holiday food in advance, the knight ordered his men to ride down to the water and look around for a fisherman's homestead. The lake was large, and there was even an island on it. No one knew its name, but it was probably called Holy Lake. In this pagan land, as if in mockery, every second lake was called holy. Their horseshoes crunched on the shells lying on the shore. Fog hung over the lake, but it was obvious it was uninhabited. There was no sign of a boat, nor a net, nor any living soul. "We'll have to search elsewhere," thought Heinrich von Schwelborn. "And if not, too bad. We'll eat what we have in our saddlebags, even if that means smoked bacon. And in Malbork, we'll make our confession. The chaplain will demand a penance, and the sin will be absolved." He was about to issue an order when something buzzed in his head under his helmet, and Hasso Planck yelled horrifyingly. Von Schwelborn looked and was struck dumb, and crossed himself. He saw 2 horses, one white and the other black. A moment later, though, he noticed in horror that the white horse had a spirally twisted horn on its domed forehead. He also saw that a girl was sitting on the black, her ashen hair combed so as to obscure her cheek. The group apparition seemed not to be touching either the ground or the water. It looked as though it were suspended above the fog, trailing over the surface of the lake. The black horse neighed. "Whoops," said the girl with the grey hair quite distinctly. "You're a lochy, you're a dead. Squeeze me." "Saint Oshla, oh my patron," mumbled Hasso, white as a sheet. The crossbowman froze open-mouthed and made the sign of the cross. Von Schwelborn also crossed himself, after which, with a trembling hand, he drew a sword from a scabbard strapped under his saddle flap. "Heilige Maria, Mutter Gottes," he roared. "Steh mir bei!" That day, Sir Heinrich didn't shame his valiant ancestors, the von Schwelborns, including Dietrich von Schwelborn, who had fought bravely at Damietta, and was one of the few not to run away when the Saracens conjured up and set a demon on the Crusaders. After spurring his horse and having recalled his fearless forebear, Heinrich von Schwelborn charged the apparition among the fresh water mussels splashing up from under his horse's hooves. "For the Order and St. George!" The white unicorn reared up like a heraldic emblem. The black mare danced, and the girl was alarmed, it was clear at first glance. Heinrich von Schwelborn rode on. Who knows how it all would have ended if the fog hadn't suddenly been blown towards him and the image of the strange group dissolved, disintegrating into a myriad of colours like a stained glass window smashed by a stone. And everything vanished. Everything. The unicorn, the black horse, and the strange girl. Heinrich von Schwelborn's steed rode into the lake with a splash, stopped, tossed its head, neighed, and ground its teeth on the bit. Hasso Planck, struggling to control his unruly horse, rode over to the knight. Von Schwelborn was huffing and puffing, almost wheezing, goggled-eyed like a fast-day fish.
"On the bones of St. Ursula, St. Cordula, and all the 11,000 virgin martyrs of Cologne,"
Hasselplank stammered out.
What was it, noble Herr Ritter? A miracle? A revelation?
Teufelswerk,
von Schwellborn grunted, only now blanching horrifyingly and chattering his teeth.
Schwarze Magie, saubere, a damned pagan devilish matter.
We ought to get out of here, sir, as quickly as possible. It's not far from Pelplin. Anything to get within the sound of church bells.
Sir Einrich looked back for the last time on a rise just outside the forest. The wind had blown away the fog, and the shining surface of the lake had grown dull and rippled in the places not obscured by the wall of trees. A great osprey circled above the water.
Godless pagan land, muttered Heinrich von Schwellborn. Much, much work, much hardship and labor await us before the order of the Teutonic Knights will finally drive the devil from this nest of Slavs.
Little horse, said Ciri reproachfully and sneeringly at once. I don't want to be intrusive, but I'm in a bit of a hurry to get back to my world. My friends and family need me. You know that, don't you? And first we end up by some lake with a ridiculous boar in checkered clothes, then run into a pack of filthy, yelling shaggy heads with clubs, and finally on a madman with a black cross on his cloak. They're the wrong times, the wrong places. Please, do try a bit harder, I beg you. Ihuarahuax neighed, nodded his horned head, and communicated something to her. A clever thought. Ciri didn't quite understand. She didn't have time to ponder, since the inside of her skull was filled with cool brightness. Her ears buzzed and her nape tingled. And black and very soft nothingness engulfed her again. Nimu, laughing joyously, dragged the man by the hand. The two of them ran down to the lake, winding their way among the young birches and alders, among stumps and blown-down trees. After running onto the sandy beach, Nimu threw off her sandals, lifted up her dress, and splashed around in bare feet in the water by the shore. The man also took off his boots, but was in no hurry to enter the water. He removed his cloak and spread it out on the sand. Nimu ran over, threw her arms around his neck, and stood on tiptoes to kiss it. The man had to lean over a long way in any case. Not without reason was Nimu called Squirt. But now that she was 18 and was a novice of the magical arts, the privilege of using that epithet was exclusively reserved for her closest friends. And some men. The man, his mouth clamped on Nimu's, put his hand down the front of her dress. It moved fast after that. The two of them ended up on the cloak spread out on the sand. Nimu's dress up above her waist, her thighs powerfully gripping the man's hips, and her hands digging into his back. When he took her, too impatiently as usual, she clenched her teeth, but quickly caught up with him in excitement, drew level, and kept up with him. She was skilled. The man was uttering amusing sounds. Nimu observed fantastic shapes of the cumuli slowly gliding across the sky over his shoulder. Something rang as a bell submerged at the bottom of the ocean rings. There was a sudden buzzing in Nimu's ears. Magic, she thought. Turning her head, freeing herself from under the cheek and shoulder of the man lying on her. A white unicorn stood by the lakeshore, literally suspended above the surface. Beside it was a black horse, and in the saddle of the black horse was sitting... But I know that legend. The thought flashed through Nimu's head. I know that fairy tale. I was a child, a little child when I heard that tale. The wandering storyteller, the beggar Pogvist, had told it to her. The witch's Ciri, with a scar on her cheek. The black mare, Kelpie. Unicorns. The land of the elves. The movements of the man, who hadn't noticed the phenomenon at all, became more and more urgent, and the sounds he was uttering more and more amusing. Whoops, said the girl on the black mare. Another mistake. It's not this place, not this time. And what's more... I see it's a bad time. I'm sorry. The image blurred and shattered as painted glass shatters, suddenly fell to pieces, disintegrated in a rainbow-coloured twinkling of sparkles gleaming in gold. And then all of it vanished.
No! Screamed Nimu. No! Don't disappear! I don't want you to go!
She straightened her knees and tried to free herself from under the man, but she could not. He was stronger and heavier than her. The man groaned and moaned.
Oh, Nemo. Oh.
Nemo screamed and dug her teeth into his shoulder. They lay on his sheepskin coat, quivering and hot. Nemo looked at the lakeshore, at the caps of foam whipped up by the waves, at the reeds bent over by the wind, at the colourless, hopeless void. The void left by the disappearing legend. A tear trickled down the novice's nose.
Nemo, is something the matter?
Yes.
She cuddled up to him, but carried on looking at the lake.
Don't say anything. Hold me, and don't say anything.
The man smiled proudly.
I know what happened, he said boastfully. Did the earth move?
Nemo smiled sadly.
Not just the earth,
she replied after a moment's silence.
Not just the earth.
A flash. Darkness. The next place. The next place was tenebrous, baleful and foul. Ciri involuntarily hunched over in the saddle, shaken, both in the literal and the metaphorical sense of the term. For Kelpie's horseshoes had thudded against something as painfully hard, flat and unyielding as rock. After a long time of gliding in very soft limbo, the impression of hardness was so astonishing and unpleasant that the mare neighed and suddenly lunged aside, beating out a staccato rhythm on the ground that made Ciri's teeth chatter. The second shock, the metaphorical one, was supplied by the smell. Ciri groaned and covered her mouth and nose with her sleeve. She felt her eyes immediately filling with tears. All around rose a sour, acrid, thick and glutinous stench, a smell of burning both choking and dreadful, impossible to define, resembling nothing Ciri had ever smelled. It was, she was certain of it, the stench of decay, a corpse-like reek of final degradation and degeneration, the odour of disintegration and destruction. In addition, there was the impression that whatever was decaying hadn't smelled any more pleasantly when it was alive, not even when it had been in its salad days. She bent over in a nauseous reflex she was unable to control. Kelpie snorted and shook her head, contracting her nostrils. The unicorn, which had materialized beside them, leaned back on his haunches, jumped up and kicked. The hard ground answered with a shock and a loud echo. All around was the night, the dark and filthy night, muffled by the sticky and reeking tatters of darkness. Ciri glanced upwards, searching for the stars, but there was nothing above her, only an abyss, lit up in places by an indistinct red glow like a distant fire.
Whoops,
she said and grimaced, feeling the sour and rotten mist settling on her lips.
Yuck! Not this place! Not this time! Under no circumstances!
The unicorn snorted and nodded his head, his horn describing a short and dynamic arc. The ground, grinding beneath Kelpie's hooves, was rock, but strange, unnaturally smooth, emitting an intensive stench of burning and dirty ash. It took some time for Ciri to realize that what she was looking at was a road. She had had enough of that unpleasant and annoying hardness. She guided the mare to the side of the road, marked by something that had once been trees, but were now hideous and naked skeletons. Corpses hung with shreds of rags, quite like the remains of rotten shrouds. The unicorn gave a warning by neighing and sending a mental signal. Too late. Just beyond the strange road and the dead trees, a heap of scree began, and further away at its edge, a steep slope running downwards almost a precipice. Ciri yelled, stuck her heels into the sides of the mare as she slipped down. Kelpie jerked, crushing whatever the heap was made of under her hooves. And it was waste, mostly some kind of strange pots. The vessels didn't crumble under the horseshoes, didn't crunch, but burst repulsively softly and stickily like great fishes' bladders. Something squelched and gurgled, and the odour belching forth almost knocked Ciri from the saddle. Kelpie, neighing wildly, trampled through the rubbish dump, struggling back upwards towards the road. Ciri, choking from the stench, grabbed the mare's neck. They managed to get up and greeted the weird road's disagreeable hardness with joy and relief. Ciri, trembling all over, looked down onto the rubbish dump, which ended in a black lake filling the bottom of the basin. The surface of the lake was lifeless and gleaming, as it wasn't water, but solidified pitch. Beyond the lake, beyond the rubbish dumps, the piles of ash and heaps of cinders, the sky was red from distant glows and was marked by trails of smoke. The unicorn snorted. Ciri was about to wipe her watering eyes with her cuff when she suddenly noticed that her entire sleeve was covered in dust. The flecks of dust also covered her thighs, the pommel of her saddle, and Kelpie's mane and neck. The stench was stifling.
"Disgusting," she muttered. "Repulsive. I feel like I'm sticky all over. Let's get out of here. Let's get out of here with all haste, little horse."
The unicorn pricked up his ears and snorted.
"Only you can make it happen. Act. Me? All alone? Without your help?"
The unicorn nodded his horned head. Ciri scratched her head, sighed, and shut her eyes. She focused. At first, there was only disbelief, resignation, and fear. But a cool brightness, the brightness of knowledge and power, quickly came over her. She had no idea where the knowledge and power were coming from, where their roots and source originated. But she knew she could do it, that she would do it if she wanted. Once more, she cast a glance at the hardened and lifeless lake, the smoking heap of refuse and the skeletons of trees. The sky was lit up by a distant glow.
"I'm glad it's not my world."
She leaned over and spat.
"Very glad."
The unicorn neighed meaningfully. She understood what he wanted to say.
"Even if it's mine."
She wiped her eyes, mouth and nose with a handkerchief.
"It's at once not mine, because it's far away in time. It's the past, or..."
She broke off.
"The past," she repeated softly. "I deeply believe it's the past."
They greeted the heavy rain, the proper downpour they fell under in the next place, as a blessing. The rain was warm and aromatic, smelling of summer, weeds, mud and compost. The rain washed the filth from them, purged them. The rain was quite simply a catharsis. Like any catharsis, it also became monotonous, excessive and unbearable after a short while. After some time, the water she was washing herself in began to wet her annoyingly, run down her neck and chill her unpleasantly. So they got out of that rainy place, for it wasn't that place either, or that time. The next place was very warm, the weather very hot, so Ciri, Kelpie and the unicorn dried off and steamed like three kettles. They found themselves on some sweltering moors at the edge of a forest. At once it could be deduced it was a very large forest, quite simply a dense, wild and inaccessible wilderness. Hope that it might be Broquelon Forest thumped in Ciri's heart, the hope that at last it might be a familiar and appropriate place. They rode slowly along the edge of the forest. Ciri was looking out for something that might serve as a sign. The unicorn snorted, raised his head and horn, and looked around. It was anxious.
"Do you think, little horse," she asked, "that they might be following us?"
A snort, comprehensible and unambiguous, even without telepathy.
"We haven't managed to flee far enough away yet."
She didn't understand what he telepathically told her in answer. There was no far or near. A spiral? What spiral? She didn't understand what he was talking about, but the anxiety infected her. The scorching moors weren't the right place or the right time. They understood it in the early evening when the heat eased off, and instead of one, two moons rose in the sky above the forest. One large, the other small. The next place was a seashore, a steep cliff from which they saw breakers crashing against strangely shaped rocks. They smelled the sea wind, and terns, black-headed gulls and petrels screeched, covering the ledges of the cliff in a restless white layer. The sea reached all the way to the dark, cloudy horizon. Down below, on the rocky beach, Ciri suddenly noticed the skeleton of a gigantic fish with a horrendously huge head partly buried in the shingles. Its great teeth, bristling in its sun-bleached jawbones, were at least 3 spans long, and it seemed one could have ridden a horse into its maw and easily paraded under the portals of its ribs without knocking one's head against its spine. Ciri wasn't certain if fish like that existed in her world and her time. They rode along the edge of the cliff, and the seagulls and albatrosses weren't frightened at all, reluctantly moving out of their way. Why? They even tried hard to peck and pinch the feathers on Kelpie and Ihuarhuax's fetlocks. Ciri instantly understood that the birds had never seen a human or a horse or a unicorn. Ihuarhuax snorted, shook his head and horn, clearly anxious. It turned out he had reason to be. Something creaked, just like canvas being torn. The terns rose with a cry and a fluttering, for a moment covering everything in a white cloud. The air above the cliff suddenly vibrated and became blurred like glass with water spilled over it. And then it shattered like glass, and darkness poured out of the rupture while riders spilled out of the darkness. Around their shoulders fluttered cloaks whose vermilion amaranth crimson colour brought to mind the glow of a fire in a sky lit up by the blaze of the setting sun. De Gruathri, the Red Horseman. Even before the crying of birds and the neighing of the unicorn had died away, Ciri had reined her mare around and spurred her into a gallop. But the air also ruptured in another place, and from the rupture, cloaks fluttering like wings, rushed out more horsemen. The semicircle of the noose closed, pressing them against the cliff. Ciri cried out, jerking Swallow out of its scabbard. The unicorn summoned her with a sharp signal that penetrated her brain like a needle. She understood at once this time. He was showing her the way, a gap in the circle. He meanwhile reared up, neighed piercingly, and charged at the elves with his horn lowered menacingly.
Little horse! Save yourself, Star Eye. Don't let them catch you.
She pressed herself against Kelpie's mane. 2 elves barred her way. They had lassos, nooses on long shafts. They tried to throw them over Kelpie's neck. The mare nimbly twisted her head out of reach of one, but didn't slow her gallop for a second. Ciri severed the other noose with a single flourish of her sword and urged Kelpie with a cry to run quicker. The mare flew like a hurricane. But others were now hard on their heels. She could hear their cries, the thud of their hooves, the flapping of their cloaks.
What about Little Horse? She thought. What have they done to him?
There was no time for reflection. The unicorn was right. She couldn't let them capture her again. She had to dive into space, hide, and lose herself in the labyrinth of places and times. She focused, sensing with horror that all she had in her head was a void and a strange, ringing, quickly growing hubbub.
They're casting a spell on me, she thought. They want to beguile me with witchcraft. Over my dead body. Spells have a range. I won't let them get close to me. Run, Kelpie!
The black mare stuck out her neck and flew like the wind. Ciri flattened herself on her neck to minimize air resistance. The cries from behind her back, a moment earlier still loud and dangerously close, faded, drowned out by the screaming of frightened birds. Then they became harder and harder to make out. Remote. Kelpie flew like a hurricane, so fast the sea wind howled in her ears. A note of fury sounded in the distant shouts of the pursuers. They understood they couldn't keep up, that they had no chance of catching up with the black mare, who was running without any sign of fatigue, as light, soft and supple as a cheetah. Ciri didn't look back, but she knew they continued to pursue her for a long time, even though it was futile. Until the moment their own horses began to wheeze and rasp, stumble and lower their foaming muzzles almost to the ground, teeth bared. Only then did they quit, sending after her nothing but curses and impotent threats she could no longer hear. Kelpie flew like a gale. The place she fled to was dry and windy. The keen, howling wind quickly dried the tears on her cheeks. She was alone. Alone again. All alone. A wanderer. A permanent vagabond. A sailor lost on the boundless sea among the archipelago of places and times. A sailor losing hope. The gale whistled and howled, rolling balls of dried weeds over the cracked earth. The gale dried her tears. Inside her skull, cool lucidity. In her ears, a buzzing. A monotonous buzzing, like from the twisted interior of a sea conch. A tingling in her nape. Black and very soft nothingness. A new place. Another place. An archipelago of places.
This night, said Nemu, wrapping herself up in a fur, will be a good night. I sense it.
Condwirimur didn't comment, although she had already heard similar assurances a good few times. For it wasn't the first evening they had sat on the terrace, the lake blazing with a sunset in front of them, and behind them the magical looking glass and magical tapestry. The curses of the Fisher King reached them from the lake, multiplied by the echo rolling across the water. The Fisher King was often in the habit of using vivid language to emphasize dissatisfaction with his angling failures, the unsuccessful strikes, plays, landings, and other techniques he used. It had gone particularly badly that evening, judging from the strength and repertoire of the oaths.
Time, said Nemu, has neither a beginning nor an end. Time is like the serpent Ouroboros, which bites its own tail with its teeth. Eternity is hidden in every moment, and eternity consists of the moments that create it. Eternity is an archipelago of moments. You may sail through that archipelago, although navigation is very difficult, and it is dangerous to get lost. It's good to have a lighthouse whose light can guide you. It's good to be able to hear someone calling among the fog.
She fell silent for a while.
How does the legend that interests us end? It seems to us, to you and me, that we know how it ends. But Ouroboros is still grasping its own tail in its teeth. Yes, how the legend ends is being settled now, at this moment.
The ending of the legend will depend on whether and when the sailor lost among the archipelago of moments sees the lamp of the lighthouse. If she hears the calling. A curse, a splash and the banging of oars in the rowlocks could be heard from the lake.
It will be a good night tonight. The last before the summer solstice. The moon is getting smaller. The sun is passing from the third to the fourth house, to the sign of the goatfish. The best time for divination. The best time.
Focus, Condwirimur's. Condwirimur's, as so many times before, obediently focused, slowly entering a state close to a trance.
Search for her, said Nemu. She is somewhere among the stars, among the moonlight, among the places. She is there. She is awaiting help. Let's help her, Condwirimur's.
Concentration. Fists at her temples. A buzzing in her ears as though from the inside of a conch. A flash. And abruptly, soft and black nothingness. There was a place where Ciri saw burning pyres. The women, bound by chains to stakes, howled wildly and horrifyingly for mercy, and the crowd gathered around, roared, laughed, and danced. There was a place where a great city was burning, roaring with fire and bursting with flames from collapsing roofs, and black smoke hooded the whole sky. There was a place where enormous two-legged lizards fought one another, and garish blood gushed from beneath fangs and claws. There was a place where hundreds of identical white windmills threshed the sky with their slender sails. There was a place where hundreds of snakes hissed and squirmed on stones, scraping and rustling their scales. There was a place where there was darkness, and in the darkness, voices, whispers, and terror. There were even more places, but none of them was the right one. She was finding moving from place to place so easy that she began to experiment. One of the few places she wasn't afraid of was those warm moors at the edge of the wild forest above which two moons rose. Calling forth in her memory the sight of those moons and repeating in her mind what she wanted, Ciri focused, strained, and plunged into the nothingness. She succeeded at the second attempt. Now encouraged, she decided to attempt an even more daring experiment. It was obvious that aside from places, she also visited times. Visigotha had talked about that, as had the elves, and the unicorns had mentioned it. Why, she had managed, albeit unwittingly, to do it before. When she had been wounded in the face, she had escaped from her persecutors into time, jumped forward 4 days, and then Visigotha couldn't account for those days. Nothing added up for him. Perhaps that was her chance. A leap into time? She decided to try. The burning city, for example, couldn't be burning permanently, could it? And if she were to get there before the fire, or after it? She landed almost in the center of the fire, scorching her eyebrows and eyelashes and arousing horrendous panic amongst the victims of the fire fleeing from the blazing city. She escaped to the friendly moors. It probably wasn't worth taking a risk like that, she thought. The devil only knows how it might end. I do better with places, so I'll stick to places. Let's try to get to places. Familiar places, ones I remember well, and ones I have pleasant associations with. She began with the Temple of Melitela, imagining the gate, the building, the grounds and the workshop, the novices' dormitory, and the rooms where Yennefer lived. She concentrated with her fists against her temples, evoking in her memory the faces of Neneca, Eurynid, Katia, and Iola II. Nothing came of it. She found herself in some swamps, shrouded in mist and swarming with mosquitoes, resounding with the whistling of turtles and the deafening croaking of frogs. She tried in turn, with no better result, Caer Morhen, the Isles of Skellige, and the banks in Gorsvelen, where Fabio Sachs worked. She didn't dare to try Sintra, knowing that the city was occupied by Nilfgaardians. Instead, she tried Vichima, the city where she and Yennefer used to go shopping. Eirhenius Krantz, sage, alchemist, astronomer and astrologer, fidgeted on a hard stool with his eye stuck to the eyepiece of a telescope. The comet of great size and power, which it had been possible to observe in the sky for almost a week, merited observation and research. A comet like that, as Eirhenius Krantz knew, with a fiery red tail, usually heralded great wars, conflagrations and massacres. Now, to tell the truth, the comet had been a bit late with its prophecy, because the war with Nilfgaard was well underway, and one could already have prophesied conflagrations and massacres correctly, without hesitation, for not a day went by without them. Eirhenius Krantz, who was familiar with the movements of heavenly bodies, was, however, hoping to calculate when, in how many years or centuries, the comet would appear again, announcing another war, which, who knows, it would perhaps be possible to prepare for better than the present one. The astronomer stood up, massaged his backside, and went to relieve his bladder from the terrace through the small balustrade. He always pissed straight from the terrace onto a bed of peonies, not caring at all about the housekeeper's reprimands. It was quite simply too far to the privy. Wasting time walking a long way to relieve himself bore the risk of the loss of valuable reflections, which no scholar could afford to do. He stood by the balustrade and undid his trews, looking at the lights of Vichima reflected in the lake. He sighed with relief and raised his eyes heavenwards.
Stars, he thought, and constellations. The Winter Maiden, the Seven Goats, the Pitra. According to some theories, they aren't just little twinkling lights, but worlds. Other worlds. Worlds from which time and space separate us. I believe deeply, he thought, that one day journeys to those other places, to those other times and universes, will be possible. Yes, it will certainly be possible one day. A way will be found. But it will demand utterly new thinking, a new, original idea that will tear apart the rigid corset called rational cognition that restricts it today.